You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, and welcome to Episode 6 of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal, and I am an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today is Edward Song, associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. Now, Ed, this is the time of year, the time of the semester, when students start coming by your office and saying, you know, Dr. Song, I haven't been to class all semester, and I've turned nothing in. How can I get my A? What's your response to that question?
If it mattered so much to you, where were you at all semester? That actually doesn't, that, you know, I don't have that experience. I mean, you hear stories like that. Students out here at Westmont are pretty conscientious by and large, and not particularly grade grubbery. So, you know, usually in my office hours, I sit around and drink coffee and, you know, record podcasts and
right,
things like that.
Right.
But
as,
no,
as it should be.
Yeah. The students out here are extremely earnest. They're pretty responsible. Yeah, so
okay,
I don't have too much of that. How about on your end?
You know, we have a sort of the full spectrum of students here. So we have certainly the excellent conscientious students. And I don't know that I've ever had anyone say, you know, I missed the whole semester and I still want an A. I think there is some realization of the work that needs to go into that. So I have not actually been asked that question myself. Variants on the question, of course, I have had. Different forms of I've not done well, I've put no work into this class, and I'm unhappy with my grade. What can I do about that, you know, a week before the deadline? And honestly, if they come in and start asking me about that, you know, a week before finals, I usually tell them that their only real option is witchcraft. But beyond that, you know, it's...
You skip Jesus in prayer and go straight to witchcraft.
Well, yeah, we're going to be talking about justice in the Bible in a couple of weeks. So we'll get to the Jesus in prayer response. Well, we should probably get to today's subject matter. We could talk about students all day being college professors, but we should talk about liberalism. Ed, can you just give us a brief recap of what we touched on in the last episode?
Yeah, so in our first liberalism episode, I tried to define liberalism as a family of political views that all share the conviction that what matters most with regard to political morality is the centrality of certain rights and liberties that are rooted in the intrinsic value and dignity that human beings possess. And so with this said, sort of like all families, you can still get a wide variety of different personalities within the same family. And so there are liberal views that recommend very different visions of social life, depending upon which of those rights and liberties they recognize or how those rights and liberties are prioritized or interpreted. So, for example, classical liberals or libertarians, they have like this really robust understanding of liberty as such, we could say. And I would call it like a very absolutist and indefensible understanding of liberty. For example, the laws that some states have requiring motorcycle helmets or seatbelts are objectionable from this perspective because they violate people's rights to do whatever they want so long as they're not hurting other people.
So you're coming out as pro-motorcycle helmet laws.
I'm definitely in favor of motorcycle helmet laws. And it was funny, when we lived in Louisiana, depending on who the governor was, it's like the first thing that they would do in office is like either the motorcycle helmet law would go in or it would go out. That was like one of the first things that Bobby Jindal did when he became governor.
So did he bring it in or did he kick it out?
Oh, he brought it in.
Okay, interesting.
I'm sorry, he kicked it out.
Okay.
He got rid of the law.
Right.
Yeah, and so right, and so that's objectionable because, hey, I have the right to ride around without a motorcycle helmet. So like this very robust understanding of liberty as like I should be free to do whatever I want to do.
Would you be in favor of it if the reason was like aggressively Darwinian? Like we're just going to remove these people from the gene pool, because if you're riding a motorcycle without a helmet, what's going to happen?
Well, you're going to have an accident and you're going to die.
Yes. So is there no part of you that's like, maybe that's okay?
Well, there certainly is a part of me, but that's probably not one of the better parts of me. And that person has children who I'm far more sympathetic about. Or that person might well have children who I would be far more sympathetic about.
Right.
You know, I think people have important liberties, but I don't think people have liberties as such. I think we have liberties that aim at particular goods. And among those goods is not the liberty of having the hair, having the wind whip through my hair as I cruise along on my motorcycle. So that in some ways gets at like the difference between libertarian liberals and progressive liberals, who also subscribe to an extensive set of liberties and rights, but they interpret these liberties differently from libertarians. And so it may be one of the important ways, the biggest difference between, say, progressive liberals and libertarians is the way they understand property rights. So libertarians have this extremely strong view of property rights that are effectively an extension of self-ownership, such that when, you know, even the government comes in and taxes you, that is morally akin to theft or even slavery, libertarians will often say. Now, liberals believe in property rights, but they just have a weaker understanding of how property rights work. But again, in general, what all liberal views share is this fundamental commitment to the priority of human rights and liberties. They just differ as to how they interpret or understand those rights and liberties.
So would you say that there's a difference, maybe not just in the emphasis of rights, but are there differences in the views of what the rights actually are?
Yeah, certainly. So again, I think libertarians, they sort of like, it's capital L liberty. And liberty is being able to do just whatever you want, so long, you know, subject to the harm principle, so long as you're not harming other people. And then I think other liberals might say, no, you don't have the right to do just anything. Not all human activities are equally worthwhile. The reason why rights and liberties matter is because they connect to important central human goods that are worth protecting. So speech is a really essential human good that's worth protecting. Assembly is an important human good. Religious freedoms and conscience, etc., these kinds of things get at important religious important human goods. But you don't have liberties to do just anything.
Right, but I'm asking more, is there a category of liberty, an entire category, maybe not just a specific application, but something that the libertarian sort of liberal would say, that is a freedom, and the more progressive sort of liberal would say, no, that's not a freedom, or vice versa. And obviously, you just use freedom of speech in a way that would encompass both groups to some extent. But are there freedoms that, from the perspective of one group or the other, they're not freedoms at all? Like, is there a sort of fundamental division between those two groups in terms of actual full categories of rights? Or are they both basically agreed that, yeah, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, so on. Those are all basic freedoms. They just disagree over the shades of those freedoms.
Well, so certainly both. I mean, I would say that all liberals agree on those familiar rights and liberties that are enshrined in documents like the Bill of Rights. Right. So you would be a weird liberal if you didn't believe in freedom of speech, for example. Now, with that said, progressive liberals might disagree on what freedom of speech entails. Libertarians might disagree about what that entails. A libertarian and a progressive liberal might disagree on what that, you know, some people have stronger understandings of that. I think that is something that's sort of equally shared by any kind of liberal. And then, again, just to reiterate, I sort of think of libertarians as understanding liberty very broadly. And so there are going to be some things that fall into that category that other liberals, and they might well be libertarians, other kinds of libertarians or other kinds of liberals say, no, we don't have that. So again, something like a libertarian might say, look, I think it's stupid, but if you want to ride around without a motorcycle helmet, it's not the state's role to be a nanny and tell you that you can't. You have the right to do that. So you have the right to wear to ride helmetless on a motorcycle.
Right.
And then lots of other people would say, no, you don't have that right. That's not a right. We don't have the rights to do just anything.
Right.
You know, there was this Michael Sandel in his textbook on justice begins with this example, this crazy case in Germany of a man who was interested in engaging in consensual cannibalism. You know this?
I've read that bit of that essay. I don't remember if I read the whole thing or not.
So he put out like an ad in the newspaper saying, I'm interested in finding somebody to eat. Please respond. And tons of people responded on a lark. And a few people responded, and it was clear that they were genuinely interested. And then he worked out a deal with one of them. And so he came over, and I think they got drunk on wine. And at one point, the guy was like, are you ready? And the other guy was like, yeah. And he cut off an appendage. I won't say which one.
Right.
But he cut off an appendage, fried it up in some olive oil. And then I think they both shared it. And so you could say, well, look, it was completely... And then I think the guy who was missing the appendage bled out and died. But, you know, there was this weird case because it was consensual, right?
Sure.
And so, and I think it's also the case that it was kind of hard to find a law that was actually broken, you know, because legislatures don't typically spend time thinking, you know, we really need to have a law prohibiting consensual cannibalism, you know, because that just comes up so much.
Right.
I'm going to run for Congress, and that's going to be, like, my big issue.
It would be a very ecumenical issue, being against consensual cannibalism.
I think that would really rally a lot of people. I could get a lot of people behind that. Anyways, and so you could see somebody defending that and thinking, well, look, the dude consented to it, and we should be free to do whatever we want. And then lots of people, I mean, lots of libertarians are going to think, well, that's crazy. But that would sort of be an example of liberty as such, free to do whatever you want so long as you're not harming other people. Now, in that instance, right. You are harming somebody, but it's consensual. But, yeah.
Okay, well, fair enough. Was there anything else from last time you wanted to touch on?
Oh, yeah, and then, you know, we walked a bit through the historical development of liberal thought, especially talking about Hobbes and Locke, and then we sort of quickly chased up to the 20th century liberal political philosopher John Rawls and his book, A Theory of Justice, and we probably spent more time than we should have going over the gory technical details of Rawls's argument. But just to simplify things a bit, Rawls defends a pretty far-reaching standard of distributive justice in which social justice requires extremely generous social provisions to the most disadvantaged class within a society. And he arrives at that conclusion because he thinks that there is this deep moral conviction that virtually everyone shares. And this is just the idea that all of us have a fundamental moral equality that's independent of many contingent facts about ourselves, such as our gender, our intelligence, and our age. And if we sort of structure that idea or model that idea in the appropriate way, we'll just see that it recommends this far-reaching understanding of distributive justice.
Right. And then we had the long discussion about whether or not that deep moral conviction that virtually everyone shares is actually something that everyone shares, or it's just the moral stuff that Rawls likes.
And it's, yes, and we decided that it was the former, that it's a conviction that everybody
shares.
Oh,
no, 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 it's certainly just the moral
even
stuff that
you,
Rawls likes.
Even you, Coyle Neal.
Let's not rehash that
conversation.
We'll get to more of that in a bit. Now, Ed, I know we're going to go into more detail over especially the modern progressivism, but before we get to that, I do want to make the conversation personal just briefly.
Mm-hmm.
What was your introduction to liberalism, and what sort of brought you around to it? What convinced you that you are a liberal?
Yeah, so, you know, both of my parents are Democrats, and it's not as if they are particularly politically engaged, but they're, you know, they vote in every election, I think. Their views are center-left, I guess I would say. And I just sort of always grew up in that environment, sort of taking for granted, Democratic. I came of age sort of in the 80s and just took for granted Democratic political morality. And it's funny, I became a Christian in college. I guess we talked about that in the first episode. And I don't know that my conversion really affected the way that I thought about politics very much at all. Oh, I suppose it came pro-life. That was sort of one big thing. But outside of that issue, I think my politics were more or less the same. And, like, you know, I'm a professional political philosopher now, but political philosophy wasn't always my interest when I was in grad school. I was aiming at quite different kinds of issues. And so, you know, for me, it wasn't until relatively late in life and relatively late into my maturation as a Christian that I started to think about issues of justice and political morality in really focused ways. I mean, really, in my last few years of graduate school, studying a lot of Rawls, for example, and that had the effect, and there were two phases, I guess, that I found Rawls compelling, and while I have certain kinds of worries, I think the picture is more or less right, and that had the effect of sort of shoring up my progressive vision of politics. And then at the same time, I started thinking about it, so again, this is sort of after that, I started thinking about it a little bit more theologically and started feeling like that progressive vision of politics was also recommended by the best understanding of the vision, the moral vision of the Old and New Testaments. And so, yeah, all of this is like relatively recent in a lot of ways as I've thought more about my political convictions and sort of worked them out in greater detail and then reflected about them theologically. How about you, Coyle?
Yeah, so I actually encountered liberalism before I encountered conservatism. So in the conservatism episode, we talked a little bit about our encounters there, and I talked about growing up in rural Montana, Wyoming, on a ranch, listening to talk radio in my high school years. Prior to that, though, one of my first political memories is the 1992 election. Mm-hmm. When George H.W. Bush was running against Bill Clinton, I was in fourth grade at the time, and I was in a unique circumstance in that I was in a heavily Democrat county in you know, rural Montana, so sort of an odd place in many ways. And somehow it came up in this fourth grade classroom that this election was going on, and all of my classmates, who at least were aware of it, were supporting Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. So I went home that day talking about this Bill Clinton guy. My parents were sounds like your parents, but kind of on the other side, sort of center right, politically active in that they vote, but not politically active in that they go out and engage in direct politics or much mm-hmm. of that. They sort of explained the two different candidates and very graciously said, you know, we are supporting this other guy and would encourage you to consider doing the same as much as that matters for, you know, a fourth grader. My mother was actually from Arkansas, so she had spent some time under Bill Clinton as governor living in his state, and did not have some terribly nice things to say about him. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of my first exposure. Then you have that stretch of time listening to talk radio, engaging with liberalism on solely a policy level and pretty much exclusively in a negative way. Mm-hmm. Which, looking back, I wish I'd been a little more thoughtful about it. You know, Bill Clinton is not exactly the most liberal of presidents. He certainly is a progressive in some ways, but he also had his conservative streak as well, depending on which way the wind was blowing and what the polls said and all of that. Going into college and then going through undergrad, I basically saw liberalism as sort of the great negative thing out there to be fought against. Mm-hmm. It was really going into grad school that I was challenged by some very conservative professors to actually sit down and read some of the foundational texts of liberalism, you know, read some Locke, read some Rousseau, read some of these German idealists, read some of the utilitarians, and kind of grapple with the foundations of liberalism rather than kind of the surface ephemera that changes from year to year. And it was useful. I'm very grateful for that. I think that was a helpful exercise in sifting through and seeing hopefully some of the real strengths of liberalism, and seeing that the problems with liberalism are not necessarily that they come out progressive comes out in favor of socialized healthcare, but rather the underlying worldview as to why they're doing that. That's what's deeply wrong with liberalism, not the policy position that, you know, Bernie Sanders happens to be taking on any given day, which we'll be talking about right now. You're free to fire back at this point. That's our history. So we should talk about 21st century progressivism. Ed, what do you think is most important when it comes to 21st century liberalism, and what should we be thinking most carefully about here?
Yeah, so I sort of wanted to make two further points in the way that I understand what liberalism is and why I think it's compelling. And they're both sort of points that are rooted in Rawls, but we don't need to, like, wade back into the technicality of that stuff. And so the first point has to do with equality and human dignity, and the second point has to do with appreciating society and the social cooperation that characterizes it. And so these are just two points that I think get at interesting and compelling things that end up recommending a progressive vision of political life. And so the first point that I want to make just starts with that idea that we find in Rawls, but certainly we don't just find it in Rawls, that we have a fundamental moral equality that is independent of the contingent facts about who we are. This was one of the big bones of contention last week, but the basic point is simply that there are lots of facts about me that are really important to me. But the value and dignity that I think I have as a person, and certainly the value and dignity that the state should recognize, doesn't turn on them, right? So if I was a woman instead of a man, or like Irish American instead of Korean American, I wouldn't have any less value than I do as a man or as a Korean American. And I say that this is a Rawlsian idea, and I've kind of given it a Rawlsian kind of a spin, but it's also obviously a Christian idea. And I would actually even go further and argue that, like, this very idea that human beings possess an intrinsic kind of dignity that deserves respect, that idea enters the Western intellectual tradition precisely because of Judeo-Christian moral convictions, right? Human beings have an indelible kind of value and dignity because we are made in God's image. And, like, that's such a familiar idea in lots of ways, but if you think about it, it's this crazy, insane, almost idolatrous idea that we are effectively little gods in some ways. And while this value that we have can certainly be tarnished or obscured because of our own brokenness, it's always there, right? Human beings just have this intrinsic kind of moral dignity and value, and I think, like, that's not particularly controversial. But then I actually think that idea by itself recommends a progressive vision of politics, right? And so how does it recommend it? Here's just, like, a really quick and dirty kind of an argument, right? The first claim is just we have an intrinsic kind of dignity and value that deserves respect. The second claim is that this dignity implies a fundamental kind of moral equality between persons. That doesn't mean that we're all the same. It doesn't mean that some people aren't more virtuous than others, but it just means that there is a kind of fundamental value that we all possess, and in virtue of that, we're all morally equal with each other. We have the same kind of status. And then I would argue that moral equality itself requires substantive equality of opportunity in as much as it can be achieved. And so just a quick word about what that means. Pretty much all liberals believe in equality of opportunity. Pretty much all liberals believe in equality in that way. Everybody should have the same opportunities. It's wrong if the government discriminates against a group of people and makes it and legally disenfranchises them from certain kinds of opportunities, from owning property or working. And pretty much all liberals believe that.
So let me make this practical for a second. Do you think that it is immoral that we do not allow immigrants to run for president? That is an opportunity that we have closed off to people who move to this country and become citizens.
Now, that's interesting. I haven't thought about that as an issue. Is it immoral?
I mean, I don't think anyone would say that with that law we are saying that immigrants have less value. I don't think we're saying that they don't have dignity or respect. But it is a place where we say this is a line that we've drawn, an opportunity that we've shut off for reasons that are historical, for reasons that have to do with not electing someone who's only lived in the country for 2 years. I mean, we could sort of run through that, and we will run through that when we get closer to the election time. But it just seems to me that there are opportunities that we close off to people without drawing conclusions about their moral value. That there are times when we say this is not available to you without saying that you have less worth as someone made in the image of God.
Yeah, so that's one example. I mean, to be honest, I don't know what to think about that. I mean, I think, and you can certainly see this in the last couple of elections where the naturalized citizen requirement has generated controversy. And I think in some ways it's a silly kind of an argument. It's a silly kind of requirement, though the idea that a person should have extended residence in the United States as a requirement makes sense for practical reasons.
Right, and I'm resisting the temptation to use the biological example of, as a man, I'm not capable of having children. That's an opportunity denied to me by virtue of my gender. Resisting it in part because I have absolutely no desire to go, to give birth. It sounds terrible. But also, again, we don't say here is a distinction between men and women that is a real-world distinction that closes off opportunities to half the population. We don't say that half of the population has less value.
Oh, no. Yeah, but when I talk about substantive equality of opportunity, I'm talking about social positions being open to
all. So, which is why you will often hear people use that biological argument. That's not actually a good one. No one's really talking
about that. I'm certainly not talking about that.
So in social terms, equality of opportunity, still there are times, there are places when we do draw those lines. You or I will never be the monarch of England, right? That's an opportunity that is closed to us.
Yeah, so equality of opportunity doesn't mean that certain kinds of, that it would be a violation of equality of opportunity that to put in place certain kinds of qualifications.
Like which family you're born into. Are you born into the aristocracy or not?
Well, but not just any kind of qualification is going to pass. So being white or being male isn't going to be the kind of qualification that passes for being able to vote, I would say.
Right.
Certain kinds of residency restrictions on political office is a different kind of a thing.
Okay, so we're pointing out that there are times when even liberals are willing to put restrictions on things. It's not sort of an absolute kind of communist style egalitarianism.
Yeah, sure. And again, and a couple things here. So substantive equality of opportunity, I mean, that's just the idea that everybody should have the same opportunity to succeed in life. And that adjective substantive is important there because that means not just legal equality of opportunity, but the chances that people have to be sort of genuinely equal. So you might say that, let's say there's a legal regime that prevents a certain class of people from working or something like that. Obviously, there is not equality of opportunity under that legal regime, precisely because there's no formal equality of opportunity, right?
Right.
Now, let's say that legal regime, you think about the United States during the Civil War, before the Civil War, before the Emancipation Proclamation. I mean, before the war was won, obviously African-American people were disenfranchised. After the Emancipation Proclamation, after the war was won, African-Americans achieved, I mean, they didn't even really achieve formal equality of opportunity, but in any case, the regime of legal disenfranchisement ended. But substantively speaking, it wasn't as if the day that that happened, all of a sudden African-American persons, former slaves, who owned no property, who were illiterate, who were still excluded by society for social reasons. It's not like all of a sudden they were equal to everybody else. So substantive equality of opportunity just means like something like the same life chances as everybody else.
Now, how do you, and I suppose this will lead into your second point here, how do you account for, when you say something like substantive life life chances or substantive opportunities, how do you account for the fact that people are born into significantly different circumstances?
Yeah, and so, you know, the last step in that argument then is that this kind of equality of opportunity can only be achieved by the modern welfare state, right? And in fact, it's going to probably be impossible to have sort of like genuine, full, exact equality of opportunity. But again, the idea is that we try to achieve this in as much as we can, subject to practical limitations and whatnot. But obviously, somebody who grows up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan to a very wealthy family has very different life prospects from a child who grows up in impoverished rural Appalachia. And then the idea is that through social welfare programs, through programs focused on education and schooling and these kinds of things, job training, economic development, the state can do as much as it can to make sure that those differences in equality of opportunity are as small as they can be.
So you're not necessarily saying that I, as someone who grew up in, you know, poor in rural Montana, should have an equal chance of becoming the CEO of Microsoft as Bill Gates' children.
Well, I mean, I am saying that, but obviously there are going to be practical limitations as to what we can achieve. And look, some people have particular kinds of gifts that other people have. I think what we're aiming for isn't that everybody has the exact same chance of being the CEO of Microsoft, but the idea is that everybody has the same chance to succeed and do well in life, right? We're not aiming to make sure that everybody has the same chance to be the starting center fielder of the New York Yankees, right? I was never going to be that, but we're aiming to make sure that everybody has an equal chance to sort of succeed and flourish in life, given their individual gifts and abilities. And then importantly, I'm not talking about equality of outcome. Right, I don't think that this necessarily recommends that everybody ends up with exactly the same, but that we should aim for substantive equality of opportunity.
Now, I think, and again, this is maybe where you're going. So when people hear the modern welfare state, what they think is that equality of outcome, right? So when at least when I'm talking to students or having a conversation with friends, if someone brings up the modern welfare state, they don't mean equality of opportunity. They often mean either positively or negatively some kind of guarantee of result, like some.
Yeah,
kind of
I think that's crazy.
Result.
You know, there is Ben Shapiro, who is a very outspoken, controversial conservative pundit. He was on campus last week, that was, talking about white privilege here, and he was sort of making the point that liberals are committed to equality of outcome. And I was like, no, I mean, I can't think. I mean, certainly there are some very hardcore academic socialist political theorists who are aiming at something like equality of outcome, but there are not many of those. And like, and we're talking in the academic world, there are not many of those. And I can't think of any living American politician, who is something for anything like substantive equality of outcome. Nobody's arguing for that. Bernie Sanders isn't arguing for that.
Right. I mean, the closest thing I can ever really think of is the movement to put the minimum wage at like $15 an hour.
Yeah.
That's sort of a push in that direction. Bringing that minimum wage up to the level of what's currently more of an average wage or I don't even know if that's average anymore because I haven't looked up the numbers on that, but kind of equalizing the bottom with the middle.
Yeah, so I would say that it's about providing people with I mean, it's certainly motivated by concerns about growing inequality in the United States. And it is, but, and it's certainly concerned with people receiving a minimum wage that they can live on, like, and live a minimally decent life. But I wouldn't say that the end, the ideal that's motivating that, that's a step in the direction of, like, absolute wage equality.
Well, not absolute, but again, that general, sort of general feeling for an equality of outcome. And of course, we wouldn't want to question the motivations of people who are in support of that sort of thing. Obviously, their concern is a decent lifestyle for the bottom economic mm-hmm. level of society. Mm-hmm. I might question their ability to do basic math, but I don't question their intent to genuinely help people. So what if you don't mean equality of outcome, what do you mean by modern welfare state? What's your view of society and social cooperation when you're thinking as a progressive?
Yeah, so for one thing, I'm committed to capitalist free markets. I think that free markets do spectacular jobs of organizing our economic life. They're really, really good at producing the goods that we want and need very, very efficiently. I also think, maybe we've talked about this in one of the other podcasts, that they can achieve this efficiency only under certain kinds of conditions, when there's perfect competition, or something approaching perfect competition and something approaching perfect information. And then I think that when it's hard to get those conditions, then it makes sense for government to help regulate those markets. And the motivation for regulating these markets isn't actually a motivation of, like, justice. It's actually a motivation of just trying to achieve economic efficiency. But maybe that's not worth talking about. But the point is, I'm sort of committed to free markets. But at the same time, government can play an important role in ensuring that the benefits, and this is something that we're going to get at in a minute, this is like my second point, but I'll just say that governments play an important role in ensuring that the benefits and burdens of social cooperation and living in a capitalist economy are distributed in equitable ways. And so what I have in mind is a modern, robust welfare state that cushions people from the dips and valleys of the free market, that helps provide people with the tools they need, maybe especially education, to get ahead in life. These kinds of things.
Okay, well, why don't we use that then to talk a little bit about that social side of stuff. Right. Where does that fit into progressivism? How do you see the role of society as being a part of what your philosophical worldview requires?
Yeah. So this is a second kind of Rawlsian point, and it gets at something in Rawls that I think is often overlooked by most scholars, but is, like, really, really important. And this is just the idea of what Rawls calls the basic structure of society. And for Rawls, the basic structure just describes those chief political, social, and economic institutions that we live under. And Rawls says that the basic structure is the primary subject of justice because, and then the quote is, because its effects are so profound and present from the start. So the idea that you get in Rawls is that our society, modern society, is characterized by these massive political institutions, social institutions, and economic institutions. And then call all of these institutions together, call that the basic structure. And what's most characterizes the basic structure of a society is that these institutions have this profound and inescapable influence over our lives. Like, the institutions grow up organically and change over time, but they shape virtually every aspect of our lives. So, for example, I mean, you know, just think about the fact that we have a cash economy and we have currency. You know, the $20 bill that I have in my pocket has value. Only, you know, currency is like this amazing thing because it makes economic exchanges so easy and efficient, right? If I have apples and want bananas, then, you know, I got to find somebody who has bananas and wants apples in order to exchange in an economic transaction. When we have currency, like, that provides a fungible mode of exchange that just makes all of that so easy, right? So that's like an amazing benefit or good society. But like, no, like, that money has value only because we all agree that it has value. And then the crazy thing is that my own economic welfare, whether I have a job or not, or how much I am paid, is influenced by the economic actions of others, right? So lots of people lost their jobs or they lost their homes because of the financial crisis, you know, which is driven by these, like, Wall Street banks making extremely risky financial decisions. And, like, so none of that has anything to do with me. You know, I bought a house, I'm paying my mortgage, but then let's say all of a sudden my house is worth 50% less for causes that have nothing to do with me and my decisions and are things that are totally outside of my control. But nevertheless, all of these actions of others shape my life in, like, the most dramatic ways.
Right. Both positively and negatively.
Yeah. So that's exactly right. It enables all kinds of really, really good things in our lives.
Right. So the negatives of everyone, you know, losing houses and losing jobs and so on when the Wall Street crash came along, also the positives of how many people had their houses and homes in the first place because of...
That's exactly right.
So it goes right. Both ways.
That's exactly right. And so, like, social cooperation in this way produces all kinds of goods, right? The social cooperation and the institutions that it creates, the basic structure, produces all kinds of benefits for us, right? It creates economic efficiencies so that we can all get wealthier and live more comfortable lives. It produces books and movies and computers and Broadway shows and music. It gives us scientific breakthroughs. It gives us modern medicine. So there are obviously lots of benefits. But the important point is that, like, all of this arises as a result of this vast cooperative system. And then for Rawls, the idea is that when a society has a basic structure like this, when it achieves this kind of complexity, that's when you need principles of justice to organize it. And what those principles do is they define the rules of social cooperation to make sure that all of the benefits and burdens of social cooperation are distributed in a fair way.
Right. And if you stop right there, I think kind of everyone is on board. Right. I think a modern conservative, a libertarian, a traditionalist conservative, you know, Platonist, I mean, whatever. If that's sort of your summary of Rawls and his view of justice and his idea of society, yeah, of course. You know, who's going to disagree with that? Where I think disagreement is going to come in is when you start giving content to what do you mean by fair way. So
yeah.
You ask, what do you mean by fair way?
Yeah, so, I mean, Rawls means that second principle of justice. But let me go back to that basic point. I actually don't think that everybody necessarily agrees with that. And, like, you might remember, there was that debate during the last presidential election in which Obama said something like, you didn't build that?
Right.
You remember that?
Yeah. It's sort of right and sort of wrong at the same time, right? I mean, you could see, well, go ahead and give us the setup for the debate just for those who don't.
And so, like, that whole and this whole debate ensued about whether that was a terrible thing to say or an obviously true thing to say. And that whole debate, I think, gets at this idea. There's a kind of ethos that's held by a lot of conservatives that because I work hard and build a business and make money, that's, like, my doing. That's my responsibility. I earned it, and therefore it is wrong for the government or anyone to come in and tax me and allow other people to benefit from my hard work. And that's a kind of an ethos that I think fails to recognize the way in which everybody's economic success arises out of the fact that we're all cooperating together, that economic success is only possible because it takes place against the backdrop of this cooperative system. And so the important point is that all of that success occurs because there is this massive cooperative system in place. Again, that money has value only because we all agree that it has value. Those goods that were produced in my factory were produced using knowledge and technology that came from others within that system. They were sold only because there was a particular system of exchange and work that was in place, a legal regime that allowed commerce to happen, employees who were probably educated in public systems, learning information in those schools that was produced by others in the systems. The goods were transported on roads that were paid for by public money. It's like, it's really difficult to capture all the ways in which the basic structure enables and shapes everything that we do. And because the system is fundamentally cooperative, it only works because everybody agrees to participate in it.
Right.
And like, I think, like, when you listen to conservatives or like libertarian conservatives, it's like their principles of justice make sense if we lived back in the 18th century. You know, in like 18th century United States, when society was agrarian and there was comparatively little economic cooperation, land was abundant, and land was really the fundamental economic resource. And all you had to do was sort of go a little bit further west, find a bit of land that nobody was on, and get by on your work, wits, and ingenuity. And like, if those are the conditions, then like libertarian principles of economic justice make more sense. So like, you know, if you and I were shipwrecked on a desert island, and you were hardworking and industrious, and I was lazy, and so you go to work and you're able to like plant these banana orchards and coconut groves, like you're living on Gilligan's Island, right? And I'm lazy and getting by the most bare subsistence levels. And, you know, we see each other, but there's very little interaction between the two of us. There's no real social cooperation. And let's say a tattered copy of Rawls's A Theory of Justice washes up on the shore. And I pick it up, and I start reading it, and I start reading about the second principle of justice. And then I go to you, and I say, Cole, you know, I just read this book. And Rawls says that we should distribute our social goods in such a way as to maximize the most disadvantaged class. You need to maximize my minimum. So I'm here for my bananas.
Which, if you actually read Rawls, you could not be that lazy.
Well, yeah. You know, I don't like hard work, but I like reading philosophy.
Right.
And anyways, like, under those conditions, like, even Rawls would say that, like, you would say, get the heck out of here, you jerk. You know, I have moral responsibilities to help those who are in need. So here's a banana. But, you know, you have no claim over my largesse.
But I think the difference here is not one over, and I know there are of course the extreme libertarians and the extreme modern liberals who are going to take those positions and say, well, you know, no one has any absolute right to anything versus you know, the sort of Ayn Rand crowd I have the right to everything. But you know, if I go out and start my own, you know, open my own coffee shop. Right now, Obama was certainly correct to say, you didn't build that. I did not invent the idea of a coffee shop. I certainly did not grow my own coffee, because if you live in the United States, unless you live in Hawaii, you don't grow your own coffee. It doesn't grow here. You know, you need a tropical climate. So there's obviously the sense in which that's true. I didn't build that. There's also the sense in which I opened the coffee shop. I'm the one putting in the, you know, 12, 15-hour days, whatever insane hours it is you have to actually run a coffee shop. Which of those sides of that argument we emphasize is going to affect the way we look at how that tax burden or that social burden ought to fall, right? If we say what matters most is my time, my work, my investment, then we're going to say fairness is my tax rate is very small. If we say what matters is that web of social stuff that goes into it, then we're going to say, well, what matters is my tax rate needs to be much higher, you know, significantly higher. Maybe not oppressive, but enough that I am paying my fair share in the broader view of society. So again, it's up until you start giving content to what do you mean by fair way. I don't know that there's a whole lot of disagreement, even to some extent amongst libertarians, because a libertarian, I assume, would admit that, yeah, I didn't invent coffee, right? I did not grow it myself. I imported it from somewhere. I mean, there's still going to be that concession. It's once we start asking, well, what is a fair way of distribution? Mm-hmm. Right? That's where we're going to say, well, it depends on how we emphasize this. And that's where, if I'm understanding you correctly, that's where you're going to see the split within liberalism between the libertarians and the more progressive liberals.
Yeah. I mean, the whole point of Rawls's argument for that second principle of justice that we talked about last time is that whole pattern of reasoning that leads to it sort of is supposed to model all of these debates, right? So you can sort of imagine a social situation in which everybody gets together and we're sort of like, look, you know, if we all agree to cooperate with each other, we're all going to do better, right? And everybody says, yeah, we're all going to do better. And then we say, look, you know, if we live in a capitalist economy and we reward people for using their gifts and ingenuity, and we reward people for hard work, that's going to grow the pie. And we're all going to do better, right? We're going to have, if we reward people for inventing computers and iPhones and make music that we like to listen to and open great coffee shops, we're all going to do better, right? And everybody says, yeah, we're all going to do better. That's going to be awesome. People shouldn't, and then everybody says, right, and so we're all going to do better if we allow for inequality. Some people are going to get more than others. And everybody says, yeah, we're all going to do better. That's great. And then we say, okay, well, how much inequality? And then Rawls thinks that the best way to model that idea is by imagining that everybody didn't know their own place in the social hierarchy, right? They didn't know if they grew up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan and they were trust fund babies, or whether they grew up homeless under an overpass, right? And then the homeless person is going to say, look, you know, I see how we're all going to do better, but I would prefer to live in a society that has pretty robust social welfare programs. And so that means that, you know, the very wealthiest people, they're going to experience higher tax rates, but they're still going to be making just like an insane amount of money. And then Rawls's specific argument is not knowing where you are in the social hierarchy. When you're choosing under conditions of uncertainty, you're going to want to make sure that the worst case scenario is as good as it can possibly be. So that's like Rawls's specific argument about that. But you can sort of imagine a less technical kind of version of Rawls. And so you can just imagine people getting together, right? And they're saying, yeah, we're all going to do better. Now, what should the tax rates on the highest income be? And the coffee shop owner says, well, you know, I think they should be 10%. And then somebody else says, well, you know, if they're 10%, then we're going to have crummy public schools, and I'm going to be living hand to mouth, and I'm not really going to be able to afford health insurance and all of these other things.
Coffee from your coffee shop.
Yeah, exactly. Right, and then we can say, you know, social cooperation produces all of these benefits, and then I'm going to say, but it just seems like the burdens of social cooperation aren't really being spread equally. Whereas if you were paying a 40% tax rate or a 50% tax rate, you're still going to be making insane amounts of money, and the burdens of social cooperation will be spread around a little bit more equitably, so I'm not living hand to mouth. Doesn't that seem more fair?
Right. So again, it's not just to make sure I'm understanding this, it's not so much that either side is saying there should be no taxes. It's a question of how we're distributing the overall requirements of society, right? The
benefits and burdens, right, of social cooperation.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, everybody agrees to taxes, though. I mean, the visions of taxes that the Republican candidates are talking about are very, I mean, frankly, they're unrealistic. But if you're talking about a 10 or a 20% flat tax, we're going to gut our country.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, that's true on both sides. I mean, if someone is talking about cutting taxes and they're not simultaneously talking about cutting spending, economically, they're wasting their time. Right. I mean, the problem is not the income of the government. The problem is that the expenses are so much more than whatever the income is. So obviously it's crazy to slash the income without also slashing the expenses. But
well, no, my point is that they're going to cut the programs, and what programs are they going to cut?
Right.
Right? So there are people who, because of changes in the economy that caused shifts in manufacturing out of urban centers and to other parts of the world, so they used to have jobs.
Right.
The economy changed for nothing that they did. It just all of a sudden everything changed. And now they're unemployed.
Right.
Right? And they're living hand to mouth. They lose their homes because they've lost their jobs. They can't keep their homes. They end up on the streets. I mean, to me, like, that's just looking at that situation. That just seems patently obvious to me that under those circumstances, the benefits and burdens of social cooperation are not being achieved in an equitable way, right? The burden on the Fortune 500 CEO of being worth $800 million instead of $2 billion, like, that benefit, that burden doesn't seem anywhere near comparable to that family losing their home and living on the streets to me.
Yeah, so kind of your point here is that the progressive view of justice is defining cooperation in a way that the people who have more pay more and the people who have less receive more. Is that fair?
Yes, but note that the people who have more pay more because they've benefited more. You know, and under very different economic arrangements, it's like those same persons might have done very badly, right? So there's a certain kind of person who's going to do very well under some kinds of social arrangements. There are other kinds of people who are going to do well under other kinds of arrangements. But the point is that, you know, they're going to pay a higher tax rate, but they are also the people who have benefited the most from social cooperation.
Now, I know we don't, because we're dealing with the philosophical side of things, we don't need to necessarily tie down an exact number here, but do you think there is a tax rate on the wealthy that is unjust? Like, is there a point where you can say, look, this guy who makes $800 billion a year is paying 80% taxes? That's not right. Like, is there an upper limit there, or are you on the progressive side enough that you're just going to say, nope, he's still, you know, bringing in, I should have done the numbers before, and he's still bringing in $20 billion a year, and that's, by no one's definition, too little of an income. I mean, is there a percentage where you can say, all right, we have now tipped the scale away from justice and into injustice by the amount of money we are taking from any one person or any one group of people?
Yeah, you know, so this is something that I've been meaning to spend more time and sort of wading through. I mean, for one thing, it's worth noting. I mean, you say 80%, and that certainly seems like an insanely high number.
Well, remember the real world, like 80%, if I make $100 billion a year and the government takes 80% of it, I still have $20 billion.
Yeah.
My lifestyle does not change at all under that system. But the government is still taking 80% of my money. I mean, it is true that 1% of Americans have, you know, a significant portion of the wealth.
1% of Americans have 40% of the wealth.
It's also true that they pay a significant portion of the taxes.
Yes.
So it, yeah, I mean, is there a point where that imbalance tips the other way? Where we're no longer being just by redistributing wealth, we're now being unjust because of the amount of wealth we have the government confiscating.
Yeah, so I don't have a number readily available on my fingertips.
Yeah, and again, we don't need a number, but is there such a point out there? Like, I assume 100% you would say, yeah, that's unjust.
Yeah, well.
So there must be a number somewhere. And if you say yes, you're already sort of distancing yourself from, you know, the Bernie Sanders crowd who say 100% tax on whatever over.
Oh, I mean, nobody really says that.
Yeah, well, I mean, the rhetoric is there.
Nobody really says that.
No, I
don't think that rhetoric is there.
I've heard that thrown around.
Well, in any case, like, I don't have a number off the top of my head. There's a kind of a technical debate amongst people who, like, think and study about Rawls about which formulation of the difference principle is sustainable. You know, so some people might say you tax them up until the point at which they're not willing to do the work anymore.
Right.
and so the pie doesn't grow, and then everybody is harmed, right? So whatever that last fraction of a percentage is in which the person says, well, look, I'm not going to start Facebook. It's just not worth it to me. You know, I'll start Facebook for $100 million, but I'm not going to do it for $99 million.
So you're sort of letting the wealthy set their own tax rate in that sense.
Yeah. It's in terms of how you structure incentives. And when whatever that breaking point is, that's where you stop, right? Because again, the way that Rawls understands the difference principle, you're trying to maximize the shares of the most disadvantaged class. So whatever tax rate is going to be the point at which it tips from one more dollar of taxation is actually going to harm the most disadvantaged class, that's the point at which you stop. I actually think that that interpretation of Rawls isn't sustainable.
Okay.
And so I would say you start with some vision of kinds of social welfare programs that are going to ensure genuine, substantive equality of opportunity. And however much that is, that's going to be the tax rates, the appropriate tax rate. And so, I don't have any kind of a priori number on that.
Right.
Suffice it to say that lots of people are going to be doing spectacularly well. And there's going to be substantial inequality between the richest person and the poor person, but substantially less inequality than we currently experience.
Right. So maybe a good summary is for Rawls, justice is lessening or softening, but maybe not eliminating inequality in society.
Yeah, that's right. And so the interesting thing about Rawls is that, like, Rawls is not an egalitarian. And the interesting thing about Rawlsian social justice is that in some ways it's more egalitarian than genuine egalitarianism, because the worst off people in Rawls' society, even though there's inequality in that society, they do better than the people in the society in which there's genuine equality.
And this obviously isn't a conservatism episode, but just as a point of comparison, we should point out that for conservatism, justice is actually found in that inequality. So the Rawlsian view of justice is equalizing, not egalitarianism, but sort of drawing the two extremes together. For conservatism, they would take more of a Platonic view. I think maybe more of a view that you find in the Bible, although we will be talking about this in a week or so, where justice is not saying that it is somehow inherently unjust that 1% of people have 40% of the wealth. Justice is telling that 1% of the people, you've been given a lot, you have greater obligations, right? So justice is not eliminating or removing inequality, it's acknowledging that it exists and explaining that there are different levels of responsibility. So it's shifting the focus around a little bit. It's telling the people who are at the top, you have a certain set of obligations to society because of what you have, and it's telling the people at the bottom, you also have a certain set of obligations that are different from the obligations of the people at the top, without trying to eliminate the difference, but trying to recognize the reality that there is a gap there, and encourage people to think about how to be just where they are.
So are you drawing a distinction between charity and justice then?
I am absolutely drawing a distinction between charity and justice. And I know that's a long conversation that we're probably going to have.
So we're going to talk about that in the next episode, Coyle? Is that our plan?
I think so. I think that's what we've got.
I think that distinction between charity and justice is absolutely and totally and completely wrong.
Yeah, I suspected that you did. And again, we'll leave this as a teaser for that, because that would be a really, really long conversation, and it probably will be. Edward, we're starting to run a little bit long here, so as we get ready to wrap up, unless you have any additional points to make.
No, that's great. Okay. I apologize for this being a Rawls fest.
No.
If you're going to pick a philosopher to sort of spend a lot of time working through, Rawls probably isn't going to be the one who's the most fun. But it has been influential for me, and I do think the arguments are interesting and persuasive.
Well, and I will repeat, he is the most important American philosopher of the 20th century. I don't think anyone could deny that. He is the one that influences the most, that matters the most. He's probably the most intelligent. He is the guy to read if you want to understand the landscape, political, moral, economic of America today. He's the guy you have to go back to. So for all of the positive and negative, I think probably mostly negative, but all of the aspects that go into that, Rawls is sort of the one who articulates it best philosophically.
You make some of the most remarkable concessions for somebody who's an avowed conservative.
You
said that Bernie Sanders is the most virtuous person in American politics. You said that Rawls is the most influential and important philosopher of the 20th century. At one point, you said that conservatives were the true ideologues. I got to keep a running list of
this. You should. I'm happy to grant the things that need to be granted. Hopefully, it makes my position stronger. Maybe I'm just undermining myself, but.
I'm going to present you with a list one of these days, and you're going to be like, wow, I said all of this?
We should keep track of this stuff and do an episode on all of the concessions, because you've made some of them, too, which we're hopefully going to see here in a second. So, Ed, why don't you tell us some of the problems with liberalism? So what are liberalism's greatest weaknesses? What's wrong with it?
Yeah, so, I can't remember if we talked about this during one of the conservatism episodes, but sometimes I do get antsy with the way in which liberals can be a little bit too breezy with the social policy solutions that they're recommending and their practicality. You can certainly see this sort of through the 70s and 80s and a lot of the social welfare programs that were established with completely good intentions but with little foresight into how exactly they would work. And I also think it's the case that capitalism is a fabulously fantastic system of economic organization, again, just because it is the system that most efficiently produces the goods that we need and care about. So I don't want to live in anything other than a free market economy. I certainly don't want to live in any kind of command economy. And I think sometimes liberals can be a little bit overly skeptical about the efficacy of the free market, or sort of think that we can always just tax and spend our way out of a social problem. That's a little bit of analogy that I sometimes have. Now, with that said, I love free markets, but I do think that actually free markets work best in certain kinds of conditions when there is important government involvement. This is something that I'd like to talk about maybe sometime in a future episode. I think healthcare is like the perfect example for that. And I also think that some of the most corrosive effects of the free market need to be softened by important kinds of government interaction. But again, it does bother me when liberals fail to sort of fully appreciate the importance of the free market in generating the goods that we care about and lifting the standard of living for everybody. And a second thing that I kind of worry about a little bit that maybe is more fundamental just gets at the centrality of liberal rights within liberal political thought. And it's often the case, again, I think the best liberal theories don't just write a blank check for human liberty and say that it's liberty as such that we ought to care about. I mean, I think the best theories don't do that. But it's certainly the case that liberal ideologies sort of tend to encourage this blind embrace of unfettered human liberty, and that I think can be a dangerous and corrosive thing. Liberty is an important human good, but what makes liberty a value isn't just the exercise of unconstrained choice and autonomy, but it's the it's how we exercise that liberty and the things that we choose to do. And I think it's often the case that liberal discourse in general, this is one of the more corrosive aspects of modernity and its emphasis on the individual as separate from society and social conditions. I think that unrestrained celebration of individualism and autonomy is a corrosive thing. How about you, Coyle? I've been raising some worries that I have about liberalism. How about we sort of switch and maybe you can talk about what positives you see in liberalism?
Yeah, so obviously we have to admit the historical good that liberalism has been. Liberals, especially, we talked last time about the original liberals, Hobbes and Locke and so on, they are the ones who first articulate the idea of rights in the modern sense of that word. There are rights before that, of course, but they're the ones who give it our modern terminology. I think that is a good thing. And even conservatism, whether you mean traditional conservatism or neoconservatism, the sort of modern liberal conservatism, both of them exist within the small L liberal framework. We are, in a sense, both of us liberals, so we can't really deny that there is some value to that. In the more specific sense of the word, you know, modern liberalism, progressive liberalism, and so on, modern liberals, progressives, are exceptionally good at identifying problems on the margins of society. I don't always agree with their answers. I don't always agree with the proposed solutions. But in terms of spotting people who genuinely need help, I think there can be a callousness in conservatism. Mm-hmm. Even for the conservatives who genuinely care about others, which I think is a larger number of us than the sort of liberal stereotype, but I think there can be an ability to overlook certain groups that otherwise escape notice, and I think modern liberals are good at identifying those sorts of peoples. They're also excellent at highlighting some of the weaknesses and human costs of capitalism. That's something that, as a conservative, it can be easy to ignore. Like you, I prefer capitalism basically over any other system, but that's not the same thing as saying that it is an unfettered good. And I think liberals are important when they remind us that there actually does need to be some kind of check, some kind of restraint in place, if only because of the existence of original sin. And this is maybe becoming less true, but if you go back and read some of the original modern liberals, which I know is sort of an odd way to phrase it, but they've been around long enough, we have to say it that way. You know, read some of the writings from the 60s and the 70s. Their concern for some of the issues that are striking society there, their concern for a materialistic worldview that they see as coming to dominate. I think, you know, any conscientious Christian can read those documents and say, yeah, there is something here. Again, it does not mean that I agree with their proposed solutions. It doesn't mean that I think they point us in the right direction, but they do identify problems that, as a conservative, it's just not terribly likely that I'm going to think of. And I appreciate the concern liberals have for the individual, sort of the inverse of what you're saying, where you think they can go too far in terms of the autonomy of the individual. That's certainly true, but I also appreciate the concern they have to respect the individual while simultaneously appreciating the life of the community. I think that modern progressives focus on that communal life and autonomy of the individual in the wrong way and at the wrong level. I think that's best focused on at the local level, and I think that's best focused on in a traditional way. But there's an impulse there, I think, that's good, even if it's directed in the wrong direction. And it's an impulse that, again, I think conservatives can be somewhat unreflective about. Ed, do you want to push back on any of that?
No, that all sounds great.
All right, well, with that, we should draw this to a close. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. Please check out the other podcasts in the family and get more information about our own podcast by visiting christianhumanist.org. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. If you've enjoyed listening to our ramblings, we'd be grateful if you left us positive reviews at iTunes. We'd also love to hear from you. You can send us your questions, comments, criticisms, and ideas at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Ed Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.